Morning, everybody. This is Jim Bianco, and welcome to our conference call. A little bit of housekeeping as usual. There's a handout. The handout was a link on the email we sent, and usually that's not a problem, but if for any reason you did have a problem accessing the handout, you can send an email to Ryan Malo. That's rmal@biancoresearch.com, and he'll turn right around and email it back to you. Okay, today's conference call is the latest on the credit crisis, and sure glad we're having the conference call this week as opposed to last week, because there's been so many changes, it's very, very difficult to get one's arms around it. But I think that at this point, while touching upon some of the changes, let me still try and fly at 5,000 feet to kind of give you a better view of where we are and what we need to do. The problem at 5,000 feet is the following. The banking system is taking losses. The banking system, because it's taking losses, is shrinking. The real economy is still trying to expand. Those two are incompatible with each other. You cannot have a shrinking financial system and an expanding real economy. The consequence of that has been that we don't have enough credit to go around, so we're rationing credit. That's why we bounce from one crisis to the next, because we're trying to find a way to get credit, and usually when something rises to the top as a problem, everybody rushes into that sector, and then somebody else gets left off the, you know, gets left behind, and then they become the problem for the following week. Ultimately, what's the fix for this? The fix for this is going to be to either stop the losses, which is a nice way of saying that either the write-downs become great enough so that, or the reserves become great enough so that we don't continue to have write-downs every quarter. That seems unlikely because the write-downs are so great that the banks and the financial firms are not in the position to reserve for an eventual, for the eventual bottom. The cause of all of the losses, which is home prices falling, stop falling, that doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. Or, and this has become in the vogue more in the last couple of days than anything else, the financial system raises more capital than it's losing. Right now it's only raised about half the capital. Now, the financial firms would tell you that they want to, but, quote, the market is not there, unquote. And that's a nice way of saying that it's not there on their terms, but we might be getting to the point where they can't, they'll have to take whatever terms they can get, somewhat analogous to what the monolines had to do to preserve their AAA rating. They'll just have to raise equity, dilute existing shareholders, watch their stock price tank, but at least they get equity raised. The Federal Reserve, and I'm kind of lump them all together, the Treasury, there's been this constant whine in the market for the last 3 months. What are they going to do? How are they going to fix the problem? What's the solution? The answer is there is no solution. The answer is that capital has returned to the banking system and has to stop shrinking. The Fed and the government, the Treasury, can offer some ideas along the way, and we'll try and discuss a couple of those. They, I think, at the end of the day, can help ease some of the pain, but they cannot fix the problem. They are artificial supports. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac buying more mortgages is an artificial support. The Fed's securities lending program is an artificial support. If they're an artificial support to buy time to wait for home prices to bottom, then they might help a lot. If they're an artificial support to buy time so that Citibank et al. Can raise more capital, then they might help. But if they're to buy time to hope that something else happens, then I think they will ease a little bit of the pain but not ultimately fix the problem. So I do think that while we're going about it in the right way, I don't think we're necessarily fixing the problem. Finally, I do think that what the Fed has done in the last, say, 2 weeks or so, between the increase of the TAF, the new securities lending program, the system RP, the Bear Stearns bailout, letting the dealers to the window is truly historic, is something that Fed scholars will write and discuss about for decades. But it's also a bit of a line in the sand. Okay, we've kind of thrown everything in there. We've shot our bolt, whatever metaphor you want to use. If this doesn't work, defined as in a week, a month, or 3 months, The credit markets are back to their panic point. They're back down near the stock market's back down near its lows. Spreads are near their wides. Everybody's worried that the financial system's coming unglued. The next act can't be as big as the last act has been. And maybe the next act, that we're already starting to see it, is going to be the demand that the financial system raises money. So that's kind of a little bottom line of where we are. So let me start us on page two and put some flesh on this. Banking losses, capital raised. This table on page two comes from Bloomberg. The table on the right shows the major financial institutions, not every financial institution. Last month I had a more comprehensive list from Deutsche Bank, but I didn't get an update of that list, so I was going to go with the more current list of the major institutions from Bloomberg. And it shows that, if you round it off, that the losses right now to date have been about $200 billion. And they're sorted by size of loss. Merrill Lynch leads, Citibank is in second, UBS third, HSBC is in fourth place. This cannot be emphasized enough. This is the problem. The banking system is losing money. They're losing capital. Remember now that the typical bank is levered around 14 or 15 to 1. For every dollar that they have in capital, they can hand out $14 or $15 in loans. I'm keeping it very simple and generic. They've lost $200 billion, just rounding it off with the table on the left. If you look at the table on the right, they've raised, rounding it off again, around $100 billion. So that means that the banking system is net down $100 billion. 14 to 15 to 1, that means that there is, in keeping it simple again, there is $1.5 trillion less of loans now than there was a year ago. And the economy needed every single dollar of those loans a year ago. The economy is attempting to expand, so we're short. Further, we're going to get another big wave of write-downs starting in April when we get first quarter numbers. We've already started the parlor game of guessing what Merrill's losses are going to be and guessing what Citibank's losses are going to be. We threw in Credit Suisse again today with the rumor, and there's been talk of UBS. All the usual suspects are in that list. So this is the problem. The banking system is losing capital. That is levered 15 to 1. For every dollar in capital they lose, that's $15 worth of loans. They're going in reverse. The economy is still growing, although we may be in recession right now. I do think we are. The capital markets are demanding loans. We don't have a financial system that can meet those needs, so we're rationing loans. Now, if we turn to page 3, the result of that rationing of loans, and for the next several pages I want to kind of illustrate this, is that we have kind of an upside-down market. What do I mean by that? Normally when you have a bear market, normally when you're going into a recession, everybody is under the impression that what happens is the lowest credit quality instruments, and that would be equities or high yield at the low end, do the worst. And everybody piles into the highest credit quality instruments. Not only is that treasuries, which is happening this time, but mortgages and agencies and munis would also qualify. Treasuries are the exception to the rule right now. Everybody is piling into treasuries. And this morning as we speak, three-month T-bills are at 54 basis points, lower than T-bills in Japan for the first time in 1993. So the U.S. now has the lowest short-term interest rates of all the major industrialized countries, and Japan no longer holds that distinction as it has for many, many years. We do as of yesterday. Everybody's piling into treasuries right now in a massive flight to quality. But away from treasuries, the highest credit quality instruments are doing on a relative, and the key word is relative basis, worse than the lower credit quality instruments. Let's take a look at the chart on page 3. Starting at you know, what are among the highest credit quality instruments? Agencies are probably right up there at the top because there's that implied guarantee. If you look at the chart in the lower left, you'll see that the agencies and swap spreads are at the highest levels in at least 10 years. Agency spreads have widened out relative to treasuries to a level that we have not seen in at least 10 years. Agency spreads narrowed a couple of days ago to 5 years by about 25, 26 basis points, which is one agency trader remarked to me, that used to be a good year. and now we did that in one day. You can see that in the top chart on the left. That just shows the same thing that the bottom chart shows, just a little bit more detail, the most recent period, and the big dive that you've seen in agency. So relatively speaking, agency securities are in the worst position that they've been in the last decade. They've had some of the biggest one-day moves that we've ever seen in that market. Keep that idea in mind. Turn the page to page 4, mortgage spreads. Here's the difference between 10-year Treasuries and 30-year Fannie Mae and 30-year Freddie Mac mortgages. On the charts on the left, they go back 24 years, almost a quarter of a century, and what they show is that mortgage spreads have been among the widest that we've seen since 1986. We're at the widest levels in 22 years in mortgages. The chart on the right just shows those spreads overlaid on the same chart with each other, and you'll see that there's been a dramatic tightening of those spreads over the last couple of days. No doubt that the story that Fannie and Freddie are getting ready to buy $200 billion worth of mortgages is coming into play. So mortgages are having their worst period in decades as well, too. Keep that thought in mind. Turn the page to muni spreads. These charts here show the Bloomberg General Obligation Municipal Bond Market Index. So this is an index of GO bonds relative to treasuries on a percentage scale. Because of the tax-exempt status of municipals, they should always trade at a lower yield relative to treasuries. That would be signified, I'm looking at the chart on the left, as 100%, and there's a gray line there at 100%. Both of these charts, again, are the same thing. It's just the one chart shows a longer detail and the other chart shows another higher detail. Starting in early March, what you saw was that municipal yields, GO yields, shot up way above treasury yields. Again, we had in the early weeks of March among one of the worst days ever in the history of the municipal bond market. And we still are, as of yesterday, well above treasury yields. Everybody has said this is an extraordinary buying opportunity in municipals. And yet everybody has said that we are making a headlong rush to get into these municipal bonds. But nevertheless, what's been happening is their spreads have not been coming down nearly as much as everybody would think. So the bottom line is that municipals, again, are showing the most extreme moves in two decades, the most extreme days ever. Let's move further down, page 6. Let's move further down the credit quality spectrum. Let's go to investment-grade corporates. That's the chart on the left on page 6 in blue. The Merrill Lynch High Yield Investment-Grade Corporate Master Index at 303 basis points in the 17th is wider now than it was at the panic levels in 2002. But if you look at high yield, go further down the credit spectrum. High yield spreads are still a few hundred, they're very wide, don't get me wrong, they are very wide, but they're still a few hundred basis points away from their 2002 wides. Relatively speaking, they're doing much better. Investment grade spreads, while they're at their wider than 2002, have not had a panic. There is no worst day in the history of investment grade, at least not yet. That's definitely not the case in high yield. We're not even back to the 2002 levels. And then finally, if you go to the end of the credit quality spectrum, which would be equities, and I don't have a chart of this because I couldn't figure out a good measure, so I thought I would just say it. Stocks have been off 17 or 18% from their October highs. Let's just go with the definition of a bear market that the media uses because it's as good as any other made-up definition, and that is a 20% is a bear market. We have not quite hit that with the S&P. The stock market has not had its worst day in 20 years. It has gone down 22% like it did in 1987. It's not had the most extreme and wild movements of our generation. That probably occurred during the 2000 to 2002 bear market. There was probably more extreme one-day movements in 1997 and 1998 than there is right now. So on a relative basis, the stock market has been doing better than everything else. What's been doing the worst is the highest credit quality instruments. Now, why is that? The answer is the financial system is shrinking. There is rationing of credit. And I'm going to be very basic here because I think basic will help explain the argument better, And I think that there's also, we also have a very wide, diverse audience here. Everybody says municipals offer value, agencies offer value, mortgages offer value. Who's ready to sell their equity portfolio and buy a portfolio of agencies that yield 100 basis points more than treasuries? And if you want to put that in raw numbers, the five-year treasury is yielding 235. Who wants to buy a portfolio of agencies that's yielding 335? The answer is nobody. What they want to do, like Carlyle was doing, is they want to buy it on 33-to-1 leverage. They want to buy it, and that same 33-to-1 leverage number is what Fannie and Freddie are using. The announcement yesterday allows them to go from 30-to-1 leverage to about 33-to-1 leverage with reducing their minimum reducing their minimum capital requirements right now. They recognize that these are value, but nobody buys these outright. You will buy stocks outright without leverage, although there is leverage in the stock market, but these markets depend on leverage. The savior for the mortgage market is a 33-to-1 levered buyer in the case of Fannie and Freddie, and that's what's got everybody all excited, that we release them of a net capital requirement so that they can lever it many times over and buy mortgages. The problem is you can't get the loan because the financial system is shrinking, or you can, you just don't like the terms because they won't allow you to lever enough to make it worth your while. That's why the highly levered end of the financial system, which is the highest credit quality instruments that are bought with the most leverage, are relatively doing worse than the lower credit quality instruments. That's why the arguments out there that the government explicitly guarantee municipals or guarantee agencies or guarantee some mortgages completely misses the point of this problem. It is not a problem that the asset quality is bad. It is a problem on the liability side that I agree, and I do agree too, that munis and agencies and mortgages present great opportunities. But if you can't get a 30-to-1 arrangement to buy these, you might not do it because it might not be worth your time. They might only offer you 10-to-1 leverage, in which case the returns to you then after leverage, given the risks, might not be worth it. And there, or the buying power isn't there to push these markets back into line. So the problem is that the financial system is shrinking, and the real world and a lot of the high credit quality instruments want to continue to expand. We're rationing credit as we move on from there. Let's go to page 7 now, keeping this in mind, and let's build upon this. The ABX index is on page 7 and the CMB index is on page 8. These markets continue to get worse. The ABX indexes, again, are credit default swap indexes measuring subprime loans. The tranches here are shown, we show the in the upper left, the AA tranche, in the lower left, the BBB- tranche, and on the right, the AAA tranche. What's the worst levels for all of these? The worst levels for all of these has been within the last 10 days. These markets did not hit their worst levels months ago and are showing any signs of stabilization. You go to page 8, the CMBX is this credit default swap index on commercial mortgages. Here I show from the upper left the AAA index to the lower right the BBB- indexes. The takeaway from all of these charts is where is the worst levels? The worst levels are in the last couple of weeks, last few days, not months ago. The worst part of these is the last part of these. The losses will continue because of FASB 157. FASB 157 has become another hot point in this discussion. The mark-to-market rule. The mark-to-market rule was brought into place because the old rule of held to maturity, available for sale in trading accounts, frankly, did not work. That was an abused system. It was a system that was inadequate, and that's why we created FASB 157. The problem with 157, of course, is that level 3 assets in the CMBXs and the ABXs all fall into level 3 assets. Level 3 assets are management judgment assets, where management gives a judgment as to what they're worth. Level one assets would be more like listed equities, like a stock in the New York Stock Exchange. Level two assets would be more like assets that you use generally accepted models, like stock options, where you would use the Black-Scholes option pricing model. It's a generally accepted model. It's not controversial to price an option based on that model. Level three is where you just have management judgment. The problem here is it isn't management judgment. It's become auditor judgment. Every auditor, whether it's PricewaterhouseCoopers or Deloitte & Touche on down the line, remembers 2001. Enron got into trouble. The first thing we did was we liquidated Arthur Andersen, and then we asked, what was the problem? The auditor took the death penalty. In fact, we even heard that last week, that there was a lot of screaming and yelling. How can the book value of Bear Stearns be $85 a share and the stock go out at two? The auditors must have screwed up. That is dangerous thinking, because what's happening is, the problem in my mind is that FASB 157 isn't the problem. It's that it's not management judgment. It's become auditor judgment, that the auditors are putting the value on level three assets. That's why you've seen the problems at Credit Suisse a few weeks ago, when they said, the auditor said, you had the wrong marks on some CDSs and they had to take the write-downs. The big controversy at AIG was the same thing. The auditor said, we don't like these numbers, you will do these numbers. The controversy with Citibank having to take some of the hedge funds onto their balance sheet that they invest in, because the auditors didn't like the valuations on these. I think the answer is not to have FASB 157 rescinded. It's not that mark-to-market accounting is killing us. It's that we're not allowing management judgment to hold sway. It's auditor judgment, and they're fighting for their life because they're afraid of what happened to Arthur Andersen with Enron and what people are saying about Bear Stearns, that if they don't put the most conservative mark on one of these level three assets and there's a problem, everybody's going to scream, let's just liquidate the auditing firm because they should pay a death penalty for having that kind of mistake. And that's where I think most of the problems with level three assets are coming from. I think the answer would be to get the auditors out of the business of valuing level three and let management come back into the business of managing level three. And I don't know if that means, you know, exonerating them from future lawsuits or something else. But that, in essence, is the problem with level three assets. The fact that ABX and CMBX are at their worst levels in the last several days, I think, is emblematic that you're going to see more write-downs because the auditors are in charge. They're going to look at these kind of benchmarks, and they're going to demand that we have big write-downs coming in the first quarter. Further shrinkage of the financial system. Further shrinkage of the financial system then means that we are going to have more rationing of credit and bigger problems. Page 9. Let me get into some of the fixes now that the government has been trying. And the government is the broad one, including the Fed, the Treasury, OFAO, everybody else, that the government has been trying to foster upon this. I will give you a general statement to say that I think that all of these are worthwhile attempts to fix the problem. I think that they can ease some of the pain at the margin, but they do not ultimately solve the problem of a shrinking financial system. That's solved by either having home prices decline, stop, or having massive injections of liquidity, more than the losses. Mortgages. Remember now, in consumer finance, almost every loan is packaged together as a security and sold, whether it's a home loan, a mortgage, a second loan, a boat loan, a car loan, a credit card loan. It's all packaged together and it's all sold. Here these charts show ABS, asset-backed security issuance, and CMO issuance from agencies and whole loans. Let me start with the charts on the left. ABS issuance for home equity loans. We used to package together about 40 ABS deals a month with a value of around $25 billion a month, and we used to sell those in the marketplace quite regularly until the beginning of 2007. That has dropped down from 40 a month at about $25 billion a month to zero in November, less than a billion in December and January, and zero in February. In the last 4 months, we've done four deals. We used to do 40 a month. If you look at total ABS issuance below, and this number is heavily influenced by subprime lending, and that's what that June of our subprime deals, that June 2006 peak at $164 billion was largely driven by subprime. We had ABS issuance of about $100 billion a month by the beginning of 2007. The one-year average is down to around $55 billion. In February, set a new low at $9 billion. It's one of the lowest numbers we've seen in a decade. The point here is what's happening in the consumer finance area is there are no more home equity deals being done. There are no more subprime deals being done. If you can get a home equity loan, if you can get a subprime loan, it's being, the word would be portfolioed or warehoused. The lender that's giving it to you is not able to package it together as a loan and sell it in the marketplace because he's a virtually non-existent, so he's holding it on his balance sheet. The problem is after 6 or 7 months of doing this, they're quickly running out of balance sheet to put this stuff on. There's very little place that they can go with it, and we're starting to get to a point now where this market is going to start to shut down. In its place, we're hoping that Fannie and Freddie are going to come in there. But the chart here on the right shows total CMO issuance as a measure of their activity is down quite substantially too. There's been a statistic that's been thrown out quite a bit that agency issuance, Fannie and Freddie were about 40 or 50% of the mortgage market back before everything got hairy in, say, 2006, and now they're about 80% of the market. What's missing from that number is the total volumes are down quite substantially. The reason that they're 80 is everybody else is practically zero, and they're down about to about one-fifth or one-sixth of the activity that they were doing just a year ago. If nobody buys these mortgages, the mortgage market isn't moving. One of the problems in the mortgage market right now, one of the things that gets lost in the mortgage market is everybody looks at interest rates, forgetting that there's two parts to the equation right now. There's the interest rates, whether or not jumbo rates are going up or down, whether or not conforming rates or adjustable rate mortgages are going up or down. And then there's also the term. So while there's been a flood of stories since the Fed cut that mortgage rates are coming down or maybe should come down or that Fannie or Freddie are going to start buying mortgages in the market in an attempt to try and bring those rates down, what's not being told is that the terms to get a mortgage are much harder right now. A year ago, 18 months ago, you can get a mortgage with 10% or 5% or zero down. Or if you wanted to go into the subprime, into the nutso stuff, you can actually get a mortgage more than 100% loan to value. But let's leave that as an exception. You could get a 10 or 5% mortgage. A year ago, if you had a credit score of less than 680, you were still, and above 620, you were still considered a prime credit, and you could still get a conforming mortgage. That's 15 to 20% of the country is between 620 and 680. You can't get a mortgage now. Starting in June, Fannie and Freddie are going to further tighten down their standards that if you have a credit score of 730 or less, 720 or less, somewhere in that range, and that's half the country, that's the bottom 50% of the country. If you have a credit score of 720 or less, and that's 50% of the country, you need 20% down to get a mortgage. So if somebody's looking to buy a $300,000 house after June, they better have $50,000 in the bank. Otherwise, they're going to have a very difficult time getting a mortgage. Well, the problem is if they have $50,000 in the bank, they don't have a credit score under 720. So the term is getting harder. So we look at the rates, and we think that the term is some stationary thing that never moves. While the rates have not come down a lot, where they've been compensating for that is making the term much harder. That's what we discussed with agencies and mortgages and munis. The rates that are being charged there on the face look very reasonable, but the leverage that they're allowing you, it doesn't exist anymore. They're forcing you to deleverage. They're not jacking your rate up to the sky. They're changing the term, and they're saying, no, you can't do it on 30-to-1 leverage. You have to do it on 10-to-1 leverage. Well, that makes your potential return one-third of what you thought it was going to be, and that changes your outlook for the investment horizon. So it's happening across the board that the term is becoming much harder because of this shrinkage in the financial system. So the result on page 10, pushing on a string, how much has the Fed helped? You can see that if you look at corporate rates, the Merrill Lynch Investment Grade Master Index has barely moved at all. High yield rates are higher. And if you go down to the bottom of the chart, showing that even though the Fed has cut 300 basis points, that there's been very little movement in mortgage rates. It's far worse than that because the terms now are much more stringent than they were, and they're going to get more stringent as we move forward from here. So let's go to page 11 and continue on. So what has the government done? I put together this list here, and I'm not going to read the whole thing to you, of all of the major announcements going back to August, and I did this off of memory, so it's not a complete list, but I think it's fairly complete. Of all of the major announcements that the government has done since February that have been to try and solve the credit crisis, most of these have been termed historic one way or another. There's about 17 or 18 of these on the list, and the last one on the list is the Fed orchestrates a bailout of Bear Stearns, which occurred, of course, on Sunday night, Monday morning. So we've had the government been extraordinarily active in this market, and they've been trying to fix this problem. And what's been happening is a lot of these have not been working. Let's take one example that was really trumpeted about 5 or 6 weeks ago. Chart on page 12 on the left. The blue line shows jumbo mortgage rates. The red line shows conforming mortgage rates. The green bar, the green line on the bottom shows the spread between the two. When Fannie and Freddie were given the temporary authority to securitize and sell jumbo rate mortgages up to about $730,000, they held press conferences and everybody said, hallelujah, problem solved. Here we are 5 or 6 weeks later, and the spread between jumbo and conforming has worsened and has gotten to a level that we have not even imagined. This was supposed to come down. This was not supposed to shoot out to new records, especially several weeks after the bill has been signed. Part of the reason that I bring this up is that the problem here is the financial system is shrinking. All of these attacks at artificial price supports, whether it's securitized jumbo mortgages. The problem with securitizing jumbo mortgages and why it doesn't work is it was never a credit quality issue in the first place. It was a liability or is a liability issue that the lending is not there to do the transactions. And increasing the credit quality of a jumbo by saying Fannie is not going to guarantee it does not address that problem. Go to page 13. The Federal Reserve has now jumped in a big way with their balance sheet. Let me start with the chart on the in the upper left. The Fed has jumped in again and has been repoing out mortgage-backed securities. They've jumped up that they've repoed out in the last month or so $148 billion of mortgage-backed securities. These are the repos that they've done over the last month or so. A lot of them were overnight, so they would inject money for a day and take it out, inject money for a couple days and take it out. In the recent weeks, they've now extended that term to 28 days. So if you look at the chart on the bottom, which goes back to 1999, it shows the total amount of repos and the TAF in the market right now. They have, you know, used the phrase flooded the system with liquidity to a degree we have not seen since the week of the Y2K crisis, when we also set up special facilities and were flooding the system with money. The Fed has been pumping money into the financial system to a degree that we've rarely seen, much more than they did during September 11th. The Fed, if you look at the charts on the right, the top chart shows the total amount of government securities holdings, and the bottom chart shows it, total with a breakdown of it is notes, bills, and tips. The Fed is also going to sterilize a lot of what they've been doing as well, too. The Fed has recently announced a securities lending program, $100 billion of system RPs at 28 days, $100 billion in the TAF, $30 billion to bail out Bear Stearns. The dealers can go to the discount window, and I'll have something on that in a second. The banks can go to the discount window now for 90 days. The Federal Reserve has committed over half of its current balance sheet to a lot of these operations. And in a lot of these operations, what's going to happen is if they just allow these collateralized loans onto their books, remember their books are the reserve accounts of all the banks, and they add more reserves to the reserve accounts of all the banks, then the effective funds rate would drop down to near zero. So as these commitments come in, they will be selling or letting bills mature or selling treasuries. So you will expect to see that their government holdings list will drop dramatically. Yesterday, they did a sale of $15 billion worth of T-bills. That will get reported, and this chart will be able to get updated tonight with the release of the H-4-1, and we should see another further drop in this. So the Fed's holdings of government securities over the next month or so should probably be halved. Now, the takeaway from this is that the Fed has an $800 billion balance sheet. It's about half the size of J.P. Morgan's. The Fed balance sheet is going to be about 50% of all of these collateralized loans. And within that, today the Fed has announced that all of the collateralized loans, you could put up any security, and they're going to make it very simple. You're going to get 95 cents on the dollar for every security you put up, regardless of what kind it is, as long as it qualifies. Not everything qualifies, but as long as it qualifies, they're not going to have this laundry list of this mortgage is worth this, this agency is worth this, this mortgage is worth that. They're just going to give you 95 cents on the dollar on everything. So the Fed is going to take a tremendous credit risk with a lot of these securities. Credit risk, if one of these firms puts up a lot of securities and they fail, the Fed is going to be sitting on huge losses as well. Now, in theory, the Fed can expand their balance sheet into infinity. But if they do extend their balance sheet into infinity, that's what we called quantitative easing in Japan. The result of that is, of course, they expand their balance sheet. They pile reserves in everybody's reserve account. Nobody ever needs to borrow Fed funds again because they're all over-reserved because the Fed's expanding their balance sheet. The Fed funds rate drops to zero, and it stays at zero, just like Japan. We have quantitative easing then at that point. And if we go into quantitative easing, the only thing I would remind you about quantitative easing is Japan did it for 10 years, and it did not work. And in an environment where commodity prices, I know they're reversing now, but in an environment up until 48 hours ago that commodity prices were rising because of a fear of inflation, the last thing that would help to, you know, assuage those fears would be some kind of a quantitative easing. Final thing I want to mention about these Fed moves is the move to allow the dealers at the discount rate window. Chart here on page 14 shows on the right discount window borrowings over the last several years. There was a big need to borrow at the window because of seasonal year-end pressures, and that's why you see that spike into January 2nd, and then it went right back down to zero. But look at that spike on September 12, 2007. Recall that the Fed changed the terms in August for the banks that they could borrow up to 30 days, and the Fed said that there was no stigma attached to borrowing at the window. Then four banks, Bank of America, Wachovia, J.P. Morgan Chase, and Citibank, all basically came out and said that they were all going to borrow $500-ish billion apiece to show everybody that it was okay to borrow at the window. But they had to give a press release because they didn't want you to misunderstand what they were doing. They didn't need the money. They just wanted to show that it was okay to borrow at the window. Nobody borrowed at the window. There was that ceremonial borrowing, and then it went back to its seasonal number of $300-400 million a day, which is what it normally is, or somewhere in that range of several hundred million dollars. Why? Because the problem, I think, with the window is it's not so much the stigma, but it's the transparency. Yesterday, I thought the Wall Street Journal unwittingly showed us the problem. They had a story about will people borrow at the window, and there was a sentence in there that said, yesterday Lehman Brothers borrowed a small amount from the window. So there you go. You borrow from the window, and the next day it's in the paper. So if any of the primary dealers, and again, Morgan and Goldman are trying to do the same thing that the other banks did in August. We're going to borrow from the window to show everybody it's okay. The fact of the matter is I don't think anybody's going to borrow from the window. Because if you go to the window next week or in 2 weeks, the next morning it's going to be in the paper, XYZ borrowed at the window, and everybody's going to know what that means. XYZ's in trouble, and there'll be a run on that brokerage firm. So no one's going to borrow at the window. How do you get people to use the window? You have to get rid of the aggregate weekly borrowing statistics for the window, and under penalty of death, you cannot tell anybody that they're borrowing at the window. Don't let anybody know if anybody's borrowing at the window or if they are, how much they're borrowing at the window, and then maybe it will be used. So, again, while the Fed is doing these moves, and I do think they're better than not doing them. Don't get me wrong. They're better than not doing them. I think that they largely cannot work, or they're addressing the issue. I mean, I'm not suggesting that the Fed say, oh, we can't do that, it won't work, we can't do that, it won't work. Go ahead and try it. I think, you know, but at the end of the day, I think we're not getting at the real issue. The real issue is the financial system is shrinking. We have to stop that shrinkage. The answer, I think, in short, of home prices bottoming is that we need to see much more liquidity injections into the financial, capital raising into the financial system. In 1991, Prince Alweed, as we all famously know, bought into Citibank. He paid roughly half book value. Citibank's book value right now is roughly $21, $22 a share. That is where the stock is trading right now. It's trading at $21.50. Half book value would be about $11, $11.50 a share. Maybe that's what we need to do, is we need to see Citibank, just to use one stylized example, start to dilute shareholders at $11 a share. Now, Vikram Pandit doesn't want to hear anybody suggest that. He knows that that could be career-ending for him to do that. John Thain knows that that could be career-ending for him to do that at Merrill. But until they raise that kind of serious capital, that if there's $200 billion of losses about to go to about $250 in the first quarter, they need to raise $300 billion. They've only raised $100. They got to raise $200 more. Go raise dollar for dollar every loss and then some. Then the capital, then the financial system will have the capital so that they won't have to ration credit, and we would stop these crises from bouncing from one sector to the next sector every single week. The moves by the Federal Reserve, the moves by Alfeo, the moves to allow Fannie and Freddie to securitize jumbos to buy mortgages are nothing more than artificial price supports, or thinking that the problem was people thought that the credit quality of these instruments was poor. That's not the problem. It wasn't a credit quality instrument. It's about leverage, and it's about getting those loans. So ultimately, I think the banking system needs to raise more capital to get this. Otherwise, this deleveraging process will continue as we move forward. This deleveraging process will hurt the highest credit quality instruments the most on a relative basis because they're the most levered. It will also hurt the lower credit quality instruments of high yield and stocks, but since they're relatively less leveraged, that's why they're not doing as bad. With that, let me thank everybody for joining us. 7 pound on your phone is the way you can get in the queue to ask us questions. If you also want to ask us questions email, we do take questions relative to email too. We also remind you that we only use first name only in questions, so be on the lookout if you do have a question that I will use your first name only. Because we find that leaving people somewhat anonymous is a better way to encourage questions. My first question as we move forward from here is an email question. It's an email question from Chris. Chris is asking, do I think that the 2003 low in 10-year treasuries at 3.10 is going to hold? I did think for a long time following the 2003 low that was going to be the cyclical low for many, many years. No, I don't think that the 2003 low is going to hold. 3.10 is what the 10-year treasury hit in June of 2003. And I used to think that that was it, that was the cyclical low. And now we're starting to approach 3.10 yet again, or at least we're within shouting distance of it currently with the 10-year treasury at around 3.37 right now. I do think, though, that ultimately, if I am correct, and that is that the problem is that the banking system needs to be reliquified, then all of these moves that the Fed has done, all these moves Ofeo has done, all of these other moves, ultimately, while maybe ease the pain for a little bit, are not going to fix the problem. That a week, a month, 3 months from now, we will be back at the way we felt Monday or Tuesday about the credit markets. And when we're at that point, Monday or Tuesday, the way we felt about the credit markets, then we're going to start to say to ourselves, well, now that the Fed has pulled out all the stops, what other trick do they have up their sleeves? And that could produce a new low yield in treasuries across the board. I might add that the 30-year did make take out its 2003 low back in January, and it's very close to potentially taking out that low again soon. For our next question, it is Tim. Tim, are you there?
Yeah, this is actually one of his teammates. But
okay.
I have two questions on mortgage related. First of all, the FAO, capital constraints reduction on Fannie and Freddie. I mean, those stocks rallied significantly on that news, which I didn't think was such a great thing. And then I just want your opinion on that. And then secondly, the Bonnie Frank $300 billion plan for mortgages. I mean, are we not really needing something that substantial? Isn't that the first one of these mortgage plans that might actually be significant?
Yeah, okay. On your questions, you kind of intimated an answer, which is exactly along my lines. First of all, OFAO, for everybody that's not familiar with what happened yesterday. OFAO, the Office of Housing Enterprise Oversight, or Finance Housing Enterprise Oversight, is the regulator of Fannie and Freddie. As you may recall, Fannie and Freddie have a long and glorious history of screwing up all the time. Their latest screw-up was that their books were cooked in 2003 or so. They admitted that all of their financial statements were a fiction. Fred OFAO then required two things of them while they got their act together, that their minimum capital requirements, they had to hold 30% more than their minimum capital requirements, and there was a limit on the size of their portfolio for their own account. That was about $700 billion in the case of Fannie and around $500 billion in the case of Freddie. When they reported their 10-K on a timely basis last month, OFAO lifted the portfolio caps on them. Now they can expand their portfolio. But they've lost money, and they're bumping up against their 30% minimum. Remember, that's 30% above minimum. Yesterday, OFAO changed that rule so that it's now they need to hold 20% above their minimum. That would free up enough capital so that they could buy roughly $200 billion worth of mortgages. And yesterday, Daniel Mudd, the CEO of Fannie Mae, was interviewed by Maria Bartiromo on CNBC on the trading floor at Fannie Mae with people sitting in front of screens holding phones to their ears, and I wouldn't be surprised if it was completely staged, saying, "We're buying right now." And when Maria asked, "What are you buying?" I'm not going to tell you so everybody can front-run me, to try and say, "We're here running to the rescue." So that's what happened yesterday. That's why the mortgage market jumped. The equity market, I'm with you, it was a complete head-scratcher to me. They are taking a huge risk right now, and that risk could wind up backfiring in the wake of big losses and potentially very punishing dilutive capital raises in the future. Fannie and Freddie made it very clear that they are doing this at the behest of the government to help stabilize the mortgage market, not because they think they can make a buck off of this. So the shareholders are taking a huge risk, and yet the stocks went straight north and are continuing to go north on this news, which I think is nothing more than a gigantic short covering. Lastly, Dick Syron, the CEO of Freddie, has also said in their investor conference call last month, he termed this the worst housing market in the last century, and we're only one-third of the way through it. Yesterday, he said, "I can't wait to have Freddie start buying mortgages until his hands bleed." Well, if his housing forecast is correct, he has just explained why Freddie is going to lose ridiculous sums of money. Doesn't matter to the bondholders. Doesn't matter to the mortgage market that they lose ridiculous sums of money. It screws the stockholders. So I don't understand the stock moves in these stocks. I don't understand if they realize that in an era of deleveraging, these guys are leveraging themselves right into the teeth of a storm. They're doing it because the government asked them to do it to try in some attempt to stabilize the market, and it could be a very bad plan. The Bonnie Frank plan, the second part of your question, for those of you not familiar, Bonnie Frank has proposed a plan that the government buy $300 billion worth of troubled mortgages. They then forgive that part of the mortgage that's underwater. So if I have a mortgage on my house and I'm underwater by $20,000, and I don't know how they're going to come up with that number, then the government will buy my mortgage and say, "Okay, Jim, will just reduce the level of your mortgage by $20,000, so you go from negative equity to zero equity. I agree with you that if we get to that point, again, that's an artificial price support on the market is what that is. And ultimately, those will work for a while, but not over the long term. $300 billion is just the beginning. That January 20th, 2009, when President Obama puts his hand on the Bible to take the oath of office, he's going to be sitting with a $700 or $800 billion deficit at that point on its way to a trillion if this plan passes, because I am in complete agreement with what you were suggesting, that $300 billion is the start. And when they do that and the home price market has not stabilized, they'll do some more and they'll do some more. Add on top of that the stimulus package that we've already blown the deficit up $168 billion. With the next stimulus package that's going to come, the slowdown in the economy leads to next tax receipts, and we could see an eye-popping deficit very, very quickly. Did you have a follow-up on that?
No, I guess just since you brought up the stimulus package, I guess I kind of had the opinion that, you know, that was a big waste of money. It would have been better used on a mortgage bailout.
Yeah, the stimulus package I thought was somewhat of a waste of money as well, too, because the problem with the stimulus package was that they just basically will start in May mailing checks to everybody. And my favorite anecdotal story about the stimulus package is the retail analyst at Bear Stearns said that they've done some studies and they think that most of that money will be spent on high-end consumer products at places like Walmart, and they actually put a buyout on Walmart because they think that people are going to go to Walmart and purchase flat-screen TVs. And one of the best comments I heard about it was, maybe the government should have just purchased $168 billion worth of flat-screen TVs and mailed one to everybody. It would have been a much more efficient way to go about the stimulus package than what we're doing right now. Mailing checks back to people is not going to necessarily fix this problem, and then telling them to please go out and spend it. As much as I like the idea of cutting taxes, this kind of haphazard, willy-nilly kind of tax cut, and it isn't even going to people that pay taxes, because if you make more than about $150,000 a year, you're not even getting a check back. It's going to go to a lot of people that actually don't make taxes, so it is more of a social program. I don't think it's essentially going to do anything. Could that money have been better spent? As I said, the banking system has lost $200 billion, and they've raised $100 that if you actually injected $150 billion of capital into the banking system, that would have actually been a far, far more productive use of that $150 billion. Of course, that brings in a host of political problems, too. Does the government then start to run Citibank, get a seat on the board? How does the government try to explain that the fat cats on Wall Street are getting that money? But if you wanted to talk about efficiency, that would have been a more efficient way to go about it. Thanks for the question.
The current talker has been muted.
Let me jump to the email questions, because I've got a couple of email questions that have come in here. Joe writes, what is your thoughts on inflation or deflation? Is deflation a la Japan likely, or will the Fed be able to reflate and inflation become more of a problem? Taking the last part, the Fed cannot reflate. I think that the Fed is trying to reflate. I think the Fed is pulling out all of the stops to reflate. That's what we've been talking about in the conference call, that all of these issues that the Fed has been attempting to do has been to try and stabilize the financial system. They cannot reflate. It's up to the banking system to fix itself, and they don't seem to be ready to start to raise punishingly dilutive equity, which I think is ultimately what's going to have to happen for them to fix this problem. Deflation, inflation, I think that the inflation part of the problem is definitely a worldwide phenomenon, that commodity prices have gotten overheated. They are breaking right now. I do not believe that what we're seeing happen in commodity prices is the end of the game. This is more like what happened in 2005, when we had that massive break in commodity prices, when gold went from $700 to $500 very quickly. Crude oil went down 28% very quickly. Copper broke off of $4 very hard. And 2 years later, we made much higher highs. And the biggest speculative bubble back in 2005, which was copper, we still made it back to $4 in copper again. We might be seeing one of these things. We might have put in the highs for the first half of this year, or we might have put in the highs in 2008 in commodities. But I don't think we've put the highs of the cycle in. They will come back and ultimately make higher highs later on down the road. So the Fed is fighting deflation. The Fed should be fighting deflation because of the shrinking financial system. The Fed is trying to reflate. I don't think it's going to work with their reflation. I think it's ultimately up to the financial system to raise dilutive equity. Commodity prices, if you want to use that as a measure of inflation, I think the bull market will continue because it's happening outside of the United States, not inside the United States. The next question, how much further do home prices have to fall to return to a normal relationship with disposable income, and what is your estimate of how long it will take? This question comes from David, and it's a good question because there's a lot of measures of home prices that look at affordability indexes. The problem with the affordability indexes is the biggest thing that drives the affordability indexes is the level of interest rates. If you get away from creative financing techniques, how do you make homes more affordable? Drive mortgage rates down to practically nothing, and then all of a sudden homes are more affordable. But if you measure home prices relative to incomes, then what that shows is that from peak to trough, you need about a 30 or 40% decline per basis Case-Shiller to get back to affordable levels. We are now down around 10 to 15% versus Case-Shiller. So like Dick Siron said, that would suggest we're about one-third of the way through this process. If the process continues at about its same level, that would suggest second half of 2009 before you would finally start to hit a bottom. What I mean by continuing at the same level, if home prices continue to decline at the levels we've seen over the last 6 or 9 months and not accelerate or flatten out, should be the second half of 2009. If we get a Barney Frank type of bill or some other kind of price support mechanism, ultimately the fix comes in when home prices get in line with personal income, and that would just make the process longer. It doesn't circumvent the process. It would just say that it would just take more time for us to eventually get to that process as well, too. With that, there are no other questions. It is running up against 60 minutes now, 1 hour, and that's what I try to limit this conference call to. So I will wrap this up right now. If you've got any other questions, you can call me. You can email me afterwards. I know a lot of people like to do that and talk one-on-one. I will be available for anybody that wants to do that. I want to thank everybody for joining us on this conference call, and we will talk to you again next month. So have a happy Easter and enjoy the long weekend. Bye-bye.